Okay, so yeah, my name is Andre. I work for Uber in New York City, and you might heard about this company. It's a small startup. You can use it to like order a ride or pizza or something like that. And I actually want to start this talk by not talking about the thing I want to talk, but instead to sort of claim some credibility, because sometimes like some dude walks on the scene and you're like, who the hell you think you are to tell me what to do and whatnot. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I do so that you might think that it's actually a good idea to listen about, like, to do the things I'm going to say here. So, claim of credibility. In Uber, we have a lot of microservices. At this point, I guess it's maybe already 1,800. Last time I checked, it was 1,700 microservices. And basically, every time we hire somebody, a new engineer, I'm pretty sure that in a few weeks there'll be like two more microservices in production. And these microservices are written in different languages, probably predominantly in Golang, Node.js, Python, I guess. And at this scale and at this fanout factor, it's really important that each and every single one of these microservices performance is top-notch, because it really matters. I work in a team that actually helps with this effort, because the team is called Observability. The idea behind this team is to provide engineers in the company with insight into whatever the hell their code is doing by giving them metrics, distributed request tracing, monitoring, alerting, and all this kind of stuff. So one of the things that we build in this team is a time series database. Well, not only database, a time series sort of platform. And it's pretty huge, I guess. We ingest about, I think, 40 or something million of data points per second. And last time I checked, like a few weeks ago, we give away about 75 years of data per second in time series as well. So this thing is written in Go. And at some point, we started to notice that something is not right with the performance of that thing, and we started to investigate. And for some period of time, that was my primary responsibility, to make sure that the performance of all the components of whatever we build is in a good shape. So I started this sort of journey into the land of Golang and stuff. So I'm gonna start with a quote from the Go engineering blog. I'm just gonna read it. So, it's been published a year, a little bit more than a year ago, I guess. And it says that Go is building a garbage collector, not only for 2015, but for 2025 and beyond. Go 1.5 GC ushers in the future where stop the world pauses are no longer a barrier to moving to a safe and secure language. It is a future where applications scale effortlessly along with hardware, and as hardware becomes more powerful, the GC will not be an impediment to better, more scalable software. So either hardware is not there yet, or the statement is a little bit too bold and forward-looking. But the only thing we've seen that scales effortlessly is the resource usage of Golang garbage collector. Let's take a look at this picture. So it's the output of PerfTop, a pretty standard Linux tool that you can use to look into whatever your code is doing right now. And you might notice that about almost 43% of the total runtime of, this is the database node that we use to store metrics. So about 43% of total runtime of this node is doing something called GC background mark worker. Oh, that's weird. And it shouldn't be that way. So let's use another tool and look a little bit more into this. So these are the flame graphs. I guess it's pretty fancy nowadays, thanks to Brendan Gregg from Netflix, who's trying to make everybody use flame graphs to understand the performance characteristics of the software they write and they run. So yeah, in this picture, you can see that the GoGC scales even more effortlessly. It's amazing, 75% of total runtime of the node is actually spent inside Go garbage collector. And, well, that shouldn't be that way, and it's pretty bad resource utilization, I must admit. So yeah, I started to look into what's going on. But before going deeper down this hole, let's do like a little bit of informational course about the garbage collection in general. So when we talk about garbage collection and garbage collectors in modern languages, we usually talk about these four sort of properties. So we talk about these four properties. The first one is whether the garbage collector is generational or not. And basically what it means is that in a generational garbage collector, the memory is divided into specific areas based on some sort of tiering policy. And because of that, the garbage collector, when it runs each cycle, doesn't need to scan everything. Because, for example, one of the commonly used tiering policy is the age of the object. So if the object was around for a while and we didn't collect it for the first, for example, four cycles, we probably won't collect it in the fifth. So how about we don't scan it every time, I scan it like every four cycles, every eight, every hundred. Or maybe this object is permanent, it's not going anywhere at all, so we don't need to scan it. We just basically ignore it and it just stays around forever. GC can be either generational or not. Another property is whether the garbage collector is compacting or not. What that means is that each time a compacting GC runs, it tries to defragment the memory, defragment the heap. Because if you allocate objects from all around the heap, then you'll basically create these holes when you return objects back. And at some point, you might arrive at a situation where when you try to allocate an object with large enough size, you just cannot find a contiguous block of memory with this size, even though you have free memory. So a compacting GC will employ different algorithms to make sure that it's not happening by compacting the heap each time it runs, or maybe once in a while. It doesn't really matter. And another good upside to for garbage collectors who have this property of being a compacting garbage collector is that you basically have zero cost allocations. Because everything is compacted, the only thing you need to do to locate a new object is basically to bump a pointer up or down. It depends on how you look at it. And here we go. This is the memory for your new object. The third property is whether it's exact or not. What it means is that an exact GC knows exactly what each byte of the memory is. If it's a pointer, if it's a typed value, or maybe something else. And that might be surprising because, like, how else would it function? But there's a bunch of garbage collectors which are not exact, and I actually go ahead a non-exact garbage collector until version, I can't actually remember, 1.2, maybe, something like that. And a very good property of, like, a very good upside and consequence of being an exact a garbage collector is that if you know where pointers are, you can move things around when you collect garbage. Because if you have an object and you want to move it somewhere else to, for example, compact the heap or optimize access or something like that, you know that there are a few pointers that reference this object and you can change them when you move the object. If your garbage collector is not exact, you cannot do that. Objects will be wired in the place forever until they are deallocated. And the last one, the last property I want to talk about is whether the garbage collector, it's not actually whether, it's the goal that garbage collector is trying to optimize for. It can be pause time, which is the thing that we read in Go engineering block like literally every release. It can be heap size, it can be something else. So yeah, speaking of the goal in garbage collector, we can see this. So that's the current garbage collector that we have in the latest Go. And when I say latest, I mean 1.8. It's not generational. It will scan memory every time, the whole thing. It's not compacting. It will not do anything to compact memory. It's kind of exact, as in like it knows what each byte of memory is, but doesn't really do anything about it. And it is goal-based, and the Golang GC goal is to minimize stop the world pause time, which again is the thing that we can see every time a new version of Go released is released. In the main section of the release notes, they claim that the pause time went even more down, and I think in 1.8 or 9, it's something like below 1 millisecond or something like that. So if we put, that's my hand drawing, you like it? So if we put the history, actually, I don't think you can actually see it, right? Yeah, well, okay. Basically, if we put the history of garbage collection on a timeline, and you do see the timeline, then what I can see, at least, you maybe cannot, is that in the 70s, something called CMS was invented, which is the concurrent mark and sweep garbage collector. It was invented as in the white paper was published. Then in 1998, Java introduced a generational garbage collector. In 2006, Java introduced escape analysis as a part of garbage collection cycle and compilation phase. In 2011, Java introduced G1GC, which is a very advanced generational garbage collector that has a lot of zones, and each of the zones can have different tendering policy, and because of that, it can actually optimize scanning to basically only scan for objects that are more or less guaranteed to be garbage. And today is 2017. So basically, there are about 50 years of research and development in the garbage collector world that Golang basically ignored, because what we have now in the language is a slight variation on the CMS theme. So, we kind of through with the garbage collection sort of super basic theory. So, going back to our issue with our software spending 75% of runtime doing collecting garbage and not doing the actual work, which is exactly the opposite from what we wanted to do, we asked this very important question that all engineers ask once in a while and maybe a few times a day. So yeah, what the hell, Golang? What is going on? And why is it spending 75% of runtime doing collecting garbage instead of actually working? So apparently, reducing stop the world pause times that Golang's development team is trying to achieve every time they release a new version is a good thing, but it has a cost, a hidden cost. And this is not what you can find on the internet. If you Google really hard, you might find something about it, but it's more or less sort of like a thing that we don't talk about. And this hidden cost is basically that every time Go reduces the stop the world pause time, this work has to be done anyway somewhere. It cannot just go away. Like the thing that you do during the stop the world phase, you still need to do this thing. So what happens is that this thing is getting moved into the background phase. And this background phase performance is linear with the number of pointers on the Golang heap. And on the 96 gig heap, which is a pretty big heap, which populated with completely simple objects like structs with integers and that kind of stuff, we've seen Go going up to 75% of total runtime being spent in garbage collection, in background garbage collection. So one important detail here is that Golang doesn't actually expose this number as a stat, like as a metric, so you cannot look into it normally. For example, what people usually do when they use Golang and they want to expose stats, like expose metrics from Golang and use like Prometheus or whatnot, is that they just basically export all the memory stats every like once in a while and they just graph it. And these memory stats, they do not expose any stats about background GC. The only thing they actually show you is the stop the world time, which is actually pretty small, like 1 millisecond or something like that, maybe 100 milliseconds, but still. And you can't really get a good insight into what's going on in the background unless you do some hacky things. So we did some hacky things, and this is what we got. So apparently there is a environment variable you can use, which is called GoDebug, and has many different options. And one of the options is something called GC trace. So if you set it to 1, then Golang will dump GC stats every once in a while into the standard output. It's not actually that fancy if you want to use it, because I added some colors and headers and stuff and removed some useless information. But it's more or less this. And I'm just going to go through this. It's not actually that complicated. So what you can see here is there are three big columns. The first one with green, red, and green stuff is the time that GC spent collecting garbage measured in wall clock. So for those of you who don't know what wall clock time is, it's pretty simple. You literally take a clock. You start when garbage collector starts. You stop it when it ends. The time that you see on the clock, on your timer, is the wall clock. The second big column here is the same thing, but this time measured in CPU clock, which is basically how many seconds, milliseconds, minutes, or whatever GC actually spent on all the cores in your system. If you have a multi-core system, this can be much more than the wall clock time. You can spend, for example, 24 seconds in 1 second if you utilize all the cores and doing some work for 1 second. And the last column with the rest of it is some basic GC stats, like we started with this amount of memory, we collected this amount of memory, and we used this number of resources to do that. So now going to each column. The first one, it has three different values. The first one, the first value in the first column, the STF, is a scan termination phase. It's a part of the stop the world phase, and it actually, in this example, oh, and mind you, these lines, they are separated by about 1.5 minutes, each of them, of the real world time. So the first column, the STF one, is the scan termination phase. It's a part of the stop the world phase. So you can see it in normal metric output of Go runtime. The second number is background mark and sweep phase, which is the background work that GC is doing. And the last one, the MTF one, is mark termination phase, which is another part of the stop the world phase, which is also pretty small. It's like 5-7 milliseconds and whatnot. But still, you can see here that the reported stats that you can see in Go metrics is that, for example, in the first line, that Golang spent about, like what, 7 milliseconds doing garbage collection and actually stopped the world for about 7 milliseconds, while in fact, it has spent almost 18 seconds collecting garbage in the background. And this data is not available, and it's not exposed, and you cannot actually know about it unless you start to see some weird artifacts. So if you look at the second big column, then this background phase timing is actually sort of explained in a little bit more detail. There are three columns there. The first one is something called GC assist. The second one is the actual background work. And the last one is something called GC idling. So what it basically means is that there are three things that Go garbage collector can do in the background. The first one is the actual background sweeping, marking and sweeping, when it goes through the pages of memory and tries to determine if, like, is this object alive? Do we need to collect it? Do we have any references to it and that kind of stuff? There is GC assist, which is a special punishment algorithm in Go runtime. The idea behind it is that if your goroutine allocates a lot of memory, then at some point Golang will stop it and tell it, no, you don't have, like, you won't get any memory unless you actually run the garbage collector yourself and free some memory first. And the last one, the GC idle, is basically that when Golang runtime sees that one of the goroutines is not doing anything, like one processor is free, it will try to run garbage collector there because, I mean, who cares? It's just idling anyway. So, yeah, you can see, like, in the first line that the assist phase in this one garbage collector cycle took about 60 seconds of CPU time. The background marking and sweeping took about 53 seconds of CPU time, and another 3 seconds was spent in the idle garbage collector. So, as I said before, each of these lines is separated by about 1.5 minutes of real-world time. So, in about 1.5 minutes, based on the first line, you can see that about 80 seconds was spent in the garbage collector in background of the wall clock time, and if you count all the cores all together, then about 2 minutes of your actual resources, of your actual CPU time, was spent collecting garbage, which is like really far away from what the Golang team actually claims on their engineering blogs about the garbage collector performance. And you can also see that by spending 2 minutes collecting garbage in the background, Golang GC managed to reduce heap from 38 gigabytes to 39, almost 40, which is not really a reduction. So good job, garbage collector. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. And it had to use 12 CPU cores to do that, which is the last column right there. So knowing that, we had another question. Okay, so why? like why GC is doing all this work, like what's happening in the background, why it has to spend 2 minutes every garbage collector cycle and take 12 CPU cores to produce absolutely zero work and actually not reduce any size of the heap at all. So to do that, we're going to talk a little bit about this thing, which is the heap bitmap. Heap bitmap is a data structure that Golang runtime uses to keep track of all the information that GC needs to use to, well, collect garbage. So the idea behind heap bitmap is that it's a thing that is populated by a type information that is generated, rather pre-generated by the compiler during the compilation of your program. So for each word, for each pointer-sized word in memory, it keeps 2 bits of metadata, which in normal case, the first bit is whether this word is a pointer or just a value, which in Golang world basically means you either follow it or just ignore it. And the second bit is a debug bit that is used for some debugging mode that will basically grind your program to the halt, and it's not really useful. And yeah, GC uses this bitmap to populate its working set each time it starts a new garbage collector cycle by first finding all the root objects, which are the objects that your program can access right now, which is basically essentially globals and everything that is on the stack of the running goroutines. And then following all the pointers from there and looking into objects that these pointers reference and using heap bitmap to determine if these objects has, if they have a pointer somewhere, and then following them further and further down. So I have this drawing to sort of illustrate this. So let's say we have a memory address 1234, and it has this data in it, which is F00D. And the first thing that GC will do is that it will go to the heap bitmap and consult it to see if this word is a pointer. Is it the actual food thing, or is it just a reference to food thing? And I have to follow it to find food. So if it has one in the first bit, then it will follow this pointer, dereference it, and scan things further. So what GC does first is just it collects, it tries to go as deep as it can and collect this working set, sort of like it's like schedule its own work to figure out what to scan and what not to scan, and then scan it. So there is another thing that can happen with heatmap. I'm just going to tell you about it anyway because it's so funny. So sometimes heatmap actually has a garbage collector bytecode program compressed with LZW that garbage collector will run every time it garbage collects. It's just crazy. I just wanted you to know that. So anyway, in normal case, it's going to just be 2 bits, either 1 or 0. And we don't care about second bit at all. So we just care about the first bit. The pointer, not a pointer. So it's kind of more or less clear that the more pointers we have, the larger the working set will be. And the larger the working set will be, the more time garbage collector will spend in background going through all these pointers and following them to determine whether we have objects that we can collect or not. So this sort of obvious conclusion that we had about this as SREs, not as software engineers, is that basically this. Okay, more pointers, bad. Less pointers, good. So we started to figure out what can we do about these pointers? What can we do to reduce the number of pointers? And first we started by digging into some like kind of quite esoteric things, trying to explore different opportunities that are kind of black magic. But then we actually found out that it's not a really sort of a big revelation that this problem exists, because apparently in Golang standard library there are special optimizations already built in that could help you reducing the number of pointers if you know that they exist. And Go standard library itself uses them a lot, but other normal engineers don't actually know about their existence. So these are the four sort of easy tricks that we learned about and used in our development process to reduce the number of pointers and reduce the number of working set and make GC faster. So I'm going to go through them real quick. So the first and foremost optimization that is a part of channels and maps is that if you declare a channel or a map of objects which have no pointers, like, for example, structures with only integers in them, or channels of like floats or something like that, then Golang compiler will mark this memory as non-interesting. And from the point of view of Golang GC, this whole block of memory, let's say you allocate a giant channel of like 1 billion integers, this whole block of memory will be marked as like, just ignore it, skip it, don't scan it. Same applies to maps. If you have a map where both keys and values are either integral types or simple structures, then the whole map will also be marked as non-scannable, non-interesting, and Golang GC will ignore it. And there are actually a few projects on GitHub that try to build like some sort of Golang replacements for Redis and that kind of stuff. And the only reason they work is because of this. The only reason they work is because they have a giant map that maps from one integer to another integer, and this giant map is not scanned by the GC. And I've been talking to some of the authors, and yeah, they had the same problem, and before they learned about this trick and before they actually utilized this thing, this project was basically sort of stillborn, and it would never work at all, because giant map with normal types is absolutely useless in Golang world. It won't work, and you'll just basically spend 99% in GC instead of doing useful work. Another trick is that pointers themselves are not necessarily they are not necessarily supposed to be pointers. There is another type in Golang which is called UNPTR, which is a type that is long enough to fit a pointer, but from the point of view of the Golang compiler, is just a number. So what you can do is, for example, if you have an object that has many references, like you have some complicated structure that you reference from a map, from a slice, from a list, or something like that, then you need to actually keep only one reference, only one real reference to it, only one real pointer, and all the other other pointers, they can be UNPTRs. And from the point of view of Golang garbage collector, it will only see one reference and it will only follow it once, which is pretty good. But yeah, you have to have at least one reference, because otherwise, if your object is only referenced by UNPTRs, it will be collected the next time GC hits, and that will lead to some really weird error messages. And the last thing I want to talk about here is closures, lambdas, whatever. It's really easy to use closures in Golang, and everybody used them, but apparently the escape analysis algorithm that Golang uses is kind of shitty. So if it sees a closure in the function, everything escapes. All variables escape. Everything is on heap. So don't use closures. If you care about your memory footprint, if you have huge heaps, don't use closures. It will hurt a lot. So next thing, after these few easy tricks, I wanted to talk about pooling. Pooling is a very common thing nowadays in Golang code that has like a considerable memory footprint. And I've seen two ways to do pooling. So yeah, if you don't know what this is about, the idea is that instead of just allocating a ton of objects every time we need them, we allocate them once, put them in a pool, and just reuse them afterwards. And this way, we sort of save on allocation. For example, you have a structure or something that has a complicated constructor, or it takes a lot of time to allocate or whatever, then instead of allocating it every time you need to use it, you can just pull it, keep it somewhere in memory, and just take it from this pool every time you use it and return it when you don't need it anymore. So there is there are two ways to do pooling in Golang. One way is the standard library sync.pool structure type. And the other one is sort of this abstract object pool, which is generally a channel-based pool that I've seen like a billion different versions on the internet, but they all work basically more or less the same way. And even though they solve the same problem and they solve them more or less in the same conceptual way, they are completely different. And I just wanted to go through this because it's very important with regards to the same problem with large heaps and a lot of pointers. So, first of all, one of the main differences between these two approaches is that the sync pool that is included in the standard library for the Golang is unbounded. If you start to push objects into this pool, you'll push objects until it's dead. It will exhaust all the memory, killer will come and kill it. That's what's going to happen. So don't do that. The object pool that is channel-based is always bounded because there are no infinite channels in Golang. The second difference is that the sync pool that's part of the Golang actually is a sort of, it kind of cheats. So the thing it does is that it has access to special runtime functions that we normal engineers cannot use. And it uses this to allocate separate per P pools. So P in Go world is a processor, which is the thing that runs the Go code, and you have Go max procs processors. So anyway, sync pool allocates one pool per P, even if you allocate only, if you declare one pool in your code, there'll be like 24 pools actually. And that kind of helps with data locality and other stuff. And we, mortal engineers, we cannot use the special functions from the runtime. So we can only have one shared pool. And this is how these pools usually implemented, the object pools from the user world. Another very important difference, and this is kind of, this difference kind of hints us towards the understanding that something is wrong with Golang memory management, maybe, is that the sync pool is purged on every GC. So there is another set of magical functions that it uses that basically sets a hook that every time GC runs, like right before it, this hook removes all the objects from the pool. So this is done for obvious reason. The obvious reason is that because we don't want objects on the heap before GC runs. The less objects we have, the better, because the GC is not generational, and we have to scan all the memory all the time. All the object pools I've seen, they retain objects on GC. Nobody does any hooks because, first of all, you cannot hook into GC as the mortal engineer. And second of all, nobody thinks about it. And the last thing is that the sync pool is lazily populated, as in like if you ask for an object for the first time, it will actually allocate it, and then we return it and put it in the pool. And object pools are usually eagerly populated, as in when you create the object, when you create this the instance of an object pool, it will just basically create like 1 billion objects and just feed them all in the channel and just then feed them to the users from this channel. So the main sort of takeaway from this pooling insight that we had is that sync pool, sync.pool, it looks kind of weird because like why do you want a pool that is purged every time GC runs? Like what's the point of this pool at all? But it gives some insights into what's going on in the GC world and what is the actual understanding of the way GC works in the Go engineering team, as in like, yeah, like we gotta purge it every time GC runs because otherwise it's gonna suck. So this is how it works, and I guess these two approaches, they both are valid, and it depends on whatever your use case is for your pooling. But we've seen that actually migrating away from object pool to sync pools actually improves performance because of this GC purging. But anyway, these are the easy tricks. Now we have some uneasy tricks. So we tried to do easy tricks. We tried to do like fiddle with pooling and do all this stuff, but it was still actually pretty bad. So we started to think further down the line about what black magic we can do about it. And the whole sort of mental thinking process we had is that, okay, so we need to remove pointers somehow. We need to make less pointers. We need to somehow reduce the number of these things on the heap. So what can we do? And eventually we arrived to this conclusion that the only thing we can do is basically this. We need another heap with blackjack and stuff, right? So that's how this thing got born. So native heap is the solution that we implemented eventually in our code, and this actually helped a lot and basically removed the problem. And it's super straightforward. It's not actually black magic-y, it's kind of simple. And the idea is that we just allocate a bunch of memory with normal mmap syscall, which is the way the memory is allocated like in C, for example, C++ or whatever. And this block of memory can be pretty huge. It can be like 90 gigabytes or whatever the amount of memory you have. Then we slice it into chunks of your type slice. Like if you want, you can allocate a native heap of a specific type. That's what we do because we just allocate time series. Or you can allocate native heap of just some arbitrary arrays of bytes and then just basically allocate objects into these arrays of bytes as long as they fit. And then some black magic happens, and you get all the profits you want. Everything works. So here's the basic idea about like a basic drawing on how it works. So you just allocate a bunch of memory with mmap. This memory is absolutely invisible for Golang garbage collector. It doesn't know anything about it. From the point of view of Golang, you just have some weird pointer that points somewhere like into the deep space. And like we just don't touch it. And we just slice it into pieces. Each piece has a tiny header, because when we return the object back to the heap, we need to know, like we need to keep track of it. We need to know where to return it to and other stuff. And the actual object itself in the heap is just an array of n bytes, where n is either the size of the object if it's a typed native heap, or it can be whatever number you want if it's an untyped heap. So yeah, native heap works, but there are a lot of downsides to it. There are a lot of upsides as well. But let's talk about downsides first. So yeah, it is invisible to the Golang garbage collector. Garbage collector will completely ignore all the references and all the pointers that point to this heap. And there's actually, again, a special code path and runtime that specifically handles this case. So again, that's like a hint, right? These people actually know about this problem. The good thing about it is that it's invisible. The bad thing about it is that since GC doesn't see it, it will not free objects from it. So you kind of back into the world of C, where you have malloc and free, or world of C++, where you have new and delete. You got to manage memory yourself. Another thing is that since this heap is invisible, and all the references on this heap are also invisible, then you cannot use heap to sort of keep real objects alive, the objects that are allocated on the Go garbage collected heap. So basically, everything you have on the native heap is sort of like a weak pointer, and you need to have a real root somewhere if you want to address it from the Golang garbage collector heap. Another thing is that all the pointers and all objects that you allocate on this native heap has to point back to the native heap. Because if they point somewhere else, it's not going to work. Garbage collector will go insane, and bad things are going to happen. And since almost all the built-in types that Golang has, like maps, channels, for example, they actually are complicated structures with a lot of stuff inside them, and we don't have access into these structures as users, we cannot allocate this kind of objects on the native heap because they will do weird stuff with pointers that we cannot control, and it's not going to work. So I have this diagram about what's okay and what's not okay with native heap. It's actually open source. I'm going to talk about this later. So if you want to try it out, you can try it out. So if you use native heap, you basically have two heaps. And on the Golang heap, what we do is that we allocate all the complicated stuff, like maps, channels, interfaces, closures, and that kind of stuff. And on the native heap, we allocate simple stuff, like integral objects, like slices, arrays, simple structs of this simple stuff. And it's totally fine to obviously reference things from Golang heap to Golang heap. That's what we all do all the time. It's OK to reference objects on native heap from the Golang heap, because from the point of view of Golang runtime, it's just going to be like a pointer to nowhere. It's just going to not touch it and whatever. It's totally fine to reference objects from native heap to native heap, because it's totally invisible from the GC point of view. So you can do whatever you want on the native heap. But it's totally not okay to reference things on the Golang heap from native heap, because if that's the only reference you have, then GC will come, it will collect your object, and you'll have a dynamic reference, which Golang runtime is like not like at all ready to handle, because it shouldn't ever happen. In this case, it can happen if you do things in a bad way. So I have a few code snippets about how it works. It's grayed out for a reason, so that you just only pay attention to the things that is colored and fun. So basically what happens here is that first we actually declare a new native heap. And in this case, we want a native heap of 1,024 objects, where each object is an array of 16 bytes. And what this thing is going to do is basically it will malloc enough memory to fit this number of arrays plus header for each array plus a little bit more for some housekeeping, like a few bytes. And it's going to give you this object that you can use to actually ask for the memory. And then this happens. So this, in this example,
I wanted to show you how to create a special ninja slice. Ninja slice, I call it ninja slice because it is a normal slice from the point of view of your program. You can use it like the same way you use your slice normally, but from the point of view of runtime, it doesn't exist. It's not a thing. So what happens here is that first, we allocate an object of the type reflect.sliceHeader. It's a type that is defined in the standard package called reflect, and it is a type that is 100% binary compatible with the actual slice. Binary as in like the memory layout, right? And we allocate a new slice header, and we set data pointer to the whatever the heap returns us when we ask for the new block of memory from it. We set the initial length to 0, and we set the capacity to 16, because this is the block size in the heap. An important thing to know here and to understand here is that, if you remember, during one of the first slides, I said that the type information for the garbage collector and for the heap bitmap is generated, pre-generated by the compiler during the compilation phase. So what happens here is that the compiler sees that we allocate an object of the type slice header. And this is the definition of this object. It has three fields, data, len, and cap. And all these fields are integers. There are no pointers. The data is not a pointer. The data is a UNPTR, which is just an integer. So when compiler sees this allocation, it marks it as non-interesting. There are no pointers. We don't care about it. Here. So even though we get a pointer, a real pointer from the heap, when then converted to UNPTR using this reflect.valueOf.pointer method that basically converts a normal pointer to UNPTR for you. So when we allocate this object, compiler generates type information for the heap bitmap and for the GC, and this type information says, there is nothing to see here. Move along. These are not the droids you're looking for. And then we do this weird trick. We just cast it to the actual slice. We convert it to the unsafe pointer first so that the type checker is not bothering us anymore. And then we tell the Go compiler that now pretend that this is actually a slice. And it works. The V, this V value is an actual slice. You can do whatever you do with normal slices, like append stuff and slice it and dice it and whatever. But from the point of view of Golang GC, it doesn't exist. From the point of view of Golang compiler, it's not a slice. From the point of view of Golang runtime, it's not a thing, we just ignore it. And this is basically the sort of the foundation of whatever we did in the database to save a lot of GC runtime, because byslice is like the most straightforward way you can represent a piece of data. And so more or less everything is a byslice. And in our version of the Golang runtime world, all these byslices don't exist, and you don't need to scan for them. And when we did that, we actually got some pretty good numbers back. So these are some graphs from the deployments before and after we introduced native heap and other tricks into our metric system. So before that, like our P99 end-to-end latency was about 2 seconds. After we deployed this thing, it went down by about 4x to something like half a second. The P99 for this small graph on the left is the query. The P99 for the query, it went down by about 3x. And P95 for the query side went down by about 4x as well. And the only thing we did is we just sort of took like 75% of all the data we have and sort of hid it away from the GC so that GC doesn't bother us anymore. And yeah, there is a downside. Downside is that now you're actually writing C in Go. But then again, isn't that what it is? Like an improved C? That's what I heard at least. So we sort of, as I see it, improved it even more, so it looks like C even more as well. And now it actually starts to work, which is pretty good. But it's not a real solution. It's kind of weird, and it's really hard to support. And when we hire new engineers and we show them this code, they're like, what is this? So there are some things to think about in the future.
Well, one thing is that we still want to move more things to the native heap. So, for example, now when we write a new service, the first thing we do is we think about the memory consumption, like memory usage patterns about the service. And like, okay, so is it going to allocate a huge heap? Okay, so what kind of stuff is going to be on this heap? Okay, so do we have like this pointer problem again? We probably do, because everything is a pointer more or less in Golang. So in this case, we need to figure out how to use native heap in basically in each case, in a case-by-case basis. But yeah, as I said, it's not the solution. So first of all, it might kind of seem that I'm just standing here and saying that Golang is like really bad and don't use it and this language sucks, which might be true. I don't know about that. But they know about this problem and they think about how to solve this. So one of the solutions that might happen in the next few Golang versions is something called ROC, Request-Oriented Collector. There is a white paper published by some people who developed the GoGC, and the basic idea is that they actually want to introduce generations into Golang because they understand that the current situation kind of sucks, and if your thing that you write in Golang is sort of heavyweight, relatively, with heaps of like 10 plus gigabytes, then it's not really going to work. So there is this idea that is basically sort of a rethinking of the normal generational CMS idea, but with a really different special tenuring policy. And this tenuring policy is not based on the age of the object, like in Java world, for example, but instead based on this idea that the majority of apps that we write in Golang are request response based apps, like servers, web servers, like RPC servers, and that kind of stuff. So this collector is gonna, like the main assumption it's gonna do is basically that if an object was allocated during the start of the request, it will probably die at the end of the request. And if it doesn't die, then it will probably live forever. And that's the hypothesis that it's that's the foundational part of this request-oriented collector. As far as I know, it's kind of moving forward, so maybe we'll see it in like, I don't know, 1.10 or something like that. Maybe as a special flag that you can enable to see if it works or not. So yeah, then if this happens, then we sort of move into the 90s with Golang GC, which is good enough, I guess. The downside of this approach is that if your app is not request response based, then you are kind of screwed. This will not work at all. So hopefully it's going to be an option or some special heuristic will figure out if it's going to work or not. And yeah, the last thing is pretty obvious, and that's what a lot of people actually do, is that if you have a really performance specific part of your stack or a part of your app in Golang needs to be really fast to manage a lot of memory, well, then don't use Go. Use a real language. And I think that was my 50 minutes. That's it.